not about to lie down for your cause. And you don't pull my strings, cause I'm a better man, moving on to better things.
Okay, welcome to Academics on Air, and you are listening with Marissa and
Jenna
and
Justin.
Yay!
Yay!
And this is our penultimate show, and just a reminder, you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford, Tufts Reform Radio, and again, this is Academics on Air, and today we have Justin, who is an astrophysics and geology double major. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure. And he's going to first be reading an article kind of about climate change and the polar ice caps, but we might also discuss some space-related things because Justin is the founder of Tufts SEDS. And can you remind us what SEDS stands for?
Yeah, it stands for Students for the Exploration and Development of Space.
Okay. So,
and related to your chosen topic for today about
Arctic amplification.
Oh, Arctic amplification. Does that have to do with your thesis as well in some ways?
Yeah, so my thesis was on, so to see if there was any, because like living in Boston, right, winters are like pretty bad and people feel like the last few winters have been even especially bad. So the question was, you know, is winter weather worse? And sort of figuring out if it is and then what could be driving it. And one of the, long story short, Boston gets like 10 extra inches of snow a year since like the mid-90s. And storms that used to be happen once a century now happen like every 4 to 5 years in Boston. And one of the things that I think could be driving that is Arctic amplification.
Mm. Cool. So I'm excited to hear you read that article. And first, we're going to go into a classic song by Vanilla Ice.
Yo, VIP. Brand new invention, something grabs a hold of me tightly, flow like a harpoon daily and nightly.
Will it ever stop?
Yo, I don't know. Turn off the lights and I'll glow to the extreme. I rock a mic like a vandal, light up a stage and wax a chump like a candle.
Dance,
crush a speaker that booms. I'm killing your brain like a poisonous mushroom.
Deadly,
when I play a dope melody, anything less than the best is a felony. Love it or leave it, you better gain weight. You better hit bulls out of kid, don't play. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook while my DJ revolves it. Tempo, I'm on a roll, it's time to go solo.
Rollin',
hit my 5.0, put my rag top down so my hair can blow. The girlie's on standby, waiting just to say hi.
Did you stop?
No, I just drove, I kept on, pursuing to the next stop. I bust a left and I'm heading to the next block. The block was dead, yo, so I continue to A1A.
Beachfront Avenue!
Girls were hot, wearing less than bikinis. Rock men love us, driving Lamborghinis.
Jealous,
cause I'm out getting mine. Shade with the gauge and vanilla with the nine.
Ready!
For the chumps on the wall, the chumps acting ill because they're full of eight ball. Gunshots ranged out like a bell. I grabbed my nine, all I heard was shells
falling
on the concrete real fast. Jumped in my car, slammed on the gas. Bumper to bumper, the avenue's packed. I'm trying to get away before the jack is jacked.
Police on the scene,
you know what I mean? They passed me up, could run it all the dope fiends. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook when my DJ revolves it. Got the hook while DJ revolves it. Yo, man, let's get out of here. Word to your mother.
Okay, you just heard a little preview of our topic today. That was Ice Ice Baby from Vanilla Ice. And we're going to transition into talking about Arctic and Antarctic ice.
Yeah.
So, Justin, thank you again for joining us. And please go ahead and read this article that you have. And is it? Can you remind us where it's from?
Yeah, so the article that I picked is from realclimate.org, which, if you don't know about it, is absolutely amazing website where professional climate scientists go on and they write these, like, essentially blog posts about, like, current big topics in the news or climate science in general in a way that is more geared towards not from experts of the field, but to people who just are sort of interested in climate in general and follow it. Unfortunately, it's not at, like, you know, the level of general public, but, you know, hopefully it will get there in the future. Mm. So my civic article is from 2006, so it's a little bit older in regard to this topic, but I thought it was pretty good because it just addresses sort of a lot of the stuff about it. So the title of my article is Polar Amplification. It was written by Cecilia Blitz, who works at the University of Washington. So should I just, like, you know, read the article verbatim? Or? Okay.
Go for it.
Yeah.
You can read as much or as little as you want.
Okay. So polar amplification usually refers to greater climate change near the pole compared to the rest of the hemisphere or globe in response to a change in global climate forcing, such as the concentration of greenhouse gases or solar output. Polar amplification is thought to result primarily from positive feedbacks from the retreat of ice and snow. There are a host of other lesser reasons associated with the atmospheric temperature profile at the poles, temperature dependence, global feedbacks, moisture transport, etc. Observations and models indicate that the equilibrium temperature change poleward of 70 north or 70 south can be a factor of 2 or more greater than the global average. The Arctic Climate Impacts Assessment, or ACIA, summarized the evidence of Arctic amplification surface warming with the statement that over the past 100 years, it is possible that there has been polar amplification. However, over the past 50 years, it is probable. But essentially what they're saying there is that when you look closer to modern times, as, like, you know, human output of greenhouse gases has gotten worse, it's more likely that we're seeing the Arctic warming way faster than the rest of the Earth. This uncertainty in the evidence of polar amplification should not be confused with the evidence for significant warming in the Arctic. Arctic warming is both highly significant and substantial. It's just not possible to say with very high confidence yet that Arctic has warmed more than the rest of the globe. The purpose of this posting is to explain why there is sometimes an absence of evidence for polar amplification. Dramatic changes in ice at the poles are often cited as evidence of recent climate change. Change such as thinning and retreat of sea ice, collapse of ice shelves along the Antarctic Peninsula and on the north coast of Greenland, melting permafrost, etc. Are these changes evidence of polar amplification? Not really. Because ice is mostly confined to the high latitudes, it is impossible to compare the magnitude changes in ice here to the rest of the globe. Therefore, it seems a mistake to consider changes in ice as evidence of polar amplification. Instead, I would argue that changes in ice are a consequence of warming, though they may play a role in causing polar amplification. Manab and Stauffer in 1980 first popularized the phrase polar amplification to describe the amplified rate of surface warming at the poles compared to the rest of the globe and their climate model's response to greenhouse gas levels. Their early climate model had a simple ocean that only represented a mixed layer of water. Their model had roughly symmetric polar amplification in the two hemispheres, except over the Antarctic continent, where they argued the ice is too thick and cold to melt back. Unfortunately, they were a little wrong. Both poles warm more at the surface than mid-latitudes or equatorial regions. Observed polar climate change in the instrumental record is not symmetric except along the Antarctic Peninsula. Most evidence of significant warming is from the Arctic. In addition, total sea ice extent in the Southern Ocean has had no significant trend since satellites began taking data in 1979. Newer climate models generally also have very modest to no polar amplification over the Southern Ocean and Antarctica in hindcasts of the last century. The presence of a deep circulating ocean component is key because ocean heat uptake increases most in the Southern Ocean as the climate warms. The asymmetry at the poles does not, however, result from a difference in feedback strength associated with the ice or atmosphere. In fact, when these climate models run to equilibrium, some say that Manab and Stauffer ran their models that ocean heat uptake is not a factor, and the hemispheres have nearly equal polar amplification. Essentially, what they're talking about there is that when you look at sort of how warm Antarctica has gotten over the past, like, 150 years compared to the rest of the globe, and how hot the Arctic has gotten, the Arctic is warming at a much, much faster rate than Antarctica or the rest of the globe. And when you sort of like do like sort of like they do these climate models and the average of like observations, you see that like the globe on average has warmed like a degree Celsius, but I mean by the end of the century it'll have warmed like a degree Celsius on average, but when you get to the Arctic you're looking at like 2 to 4 is the most probable range. It is well established that climate models exhibit Arctic amplification of future climate change. In addition, averaging over numerous hindcasts from a single model started with differing initial conditions yields significant Arctic amplification in simulations of the last century. However, single realizations with a climate model do not universally show Arctic amplification in the past. Thus, models and observations alike show uncertain Arctic amplification in the last century. Nonetheless, Arctic amplification in models, and most likely nature too, is a robust result of forced climate change, providing the forcing sufficiently large to overcome an internal climate variability. Our Antarctic amplification only occurs if the model is run long enough so ocean heat uptake in southern ocean does not damp the positive feedbacks, and if trends in stratospheric ozone do not cause compensatory cooling. Predictions of climate models indicate that Arctic amplification will be significant above the 95% confidence level in 1 to 2 decades, so about where we're at now. While significant Arctic polar amplification will take much longer, a lack of polar amplification over relatively short time periods is therefore understandable and does not undermine the credibility of climate models or climate theory in any way.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Do you have any questions, Vernon?
Yeah, well... Okay. First off, thank you so much for taking some time to explain that as you were reading it, because I'm sure for myself and for many listeners, there are technical terms in that, but also I think you did a good job of trying to pause there, and I think there might still be a little bit more of clarification that I'd like to go into to ask you about. But I guess before those clarifying questions, I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more on in what contexts Arctic amplification has entered into your academics and your, like, where have you learned about it and why do you feel like it's really important to talk about?
Yeah, so when I was working on my thesis, I was trying to figure out, you know, what could cause increases in snowfall, sort of like in Boston, in Philadelphia, in New York City. It was where I was seeing like these massive changes in snowfall over the past like 25, 30 years. And so I, like, you know, was reading a bunch of literature and scientific literature about it, and a lot of people, it's kind of the one of the biggest arguments right now in climate science is sort of like, you know, is like weather getting more extreme and what is driving it. And a lot of people believe that like the mid latitudes, so if like between like Florida and like, you know, Montreal, which is where most people in the world live, it's driven by Arctic amplification in the northern hemisphere. And essentially what's happening is that as the Arctic gets hotter, because as the ice melts, so the ocean is able to get hotter, which melts more ice, so the ocean gets hotter, and it just keeps happening and happening and happening, so the Arctic gets really, really hot. And because now the Arctic is now, like, much warmer than it used to be, you know, it changes sort of how the Earth moves heat around and sort of circulation in general. Because everything on Earth, like in the Earth's atmosphere and the oceans, is driven almost entirely by heat and, like, differences in heat between two locations. So if the Arctic is warmer, then everywhere is getting warmer than everywhere else south of it. I mean, it's warming at a faster rate, then sort of like that temperature difference is decreasing and the atmosphere isn't moving as much. So if you have like extremely hot air, like which means that people expect, for example, like droughts to last longer because like this region of almost no moisture is just sitting in one place for much longer because there's less wind overall. Or you get like extremely cold temperatures for much longer period of time over one location, which leads to like more snow. And that's kind of how it entered in to my, how it enters into like weather where we live and sort of how it entered into my sort of like academic research.
And I know the article discusses both the Arctic and the Antarctic. Has your research primarily been in the Northern Hemisphere and looking at the Arctic?
Yeah, so my focus was entirely on locations across between like Virginia and Maine in the U.S. like on the coast, and so just impacts of Antarctica on there just, you know, are negligible on, because it just, you know, there isn't really much impact Antarctica can have across the entire globe, but just in general, Antarctica is really unique compared, is very different compared to the Arctic, both because, you know, the Arctic has no land. It's just ocean with ice on it. Whereas Antarctica, there's an entire continent down there. And then Antarctica has unique ocean and air patterns around it, which kind of isolate it very much from the rest of the globe. And so it's much harder for anything that happens in Antarctica to affect anywhere else on Earth. But the Arctic doesn't have that, and it has very, very, and people believe it has very strong impacts on weather and climate where people live, where in the most populated areas of the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm. And I was drawing that question just to repeat from this sentence, just to repeat in the article that says, predictions with climate models indicate that Arctic amplification will be significant in 1 to 2 decades, while significant Antarctic polar amplification will take much longer. So yeah. Interesting to hear you talk more about that.
Yeah, that kind of goes into my question. I don't know if it's just maybe I didn't quite understand, or maybe the article didn't even address this, so I'm kind of curious. You were saying, I don't know if you were just talking about the Arctic specifically, but like it's warming at a rate of like 2 to 4 degrees Celsius versus the rest of the
Arctic. When you compare sort of like how hot the Arctic was on average from like in like the 1950s through like 2000, between how hot they expect to be in like 2080 to 2100, the difference is like 2 to 4 degrees, mm-hmm. whereas look at the rest of the globe, they expect it to be like 1 degree.
And is that just the Arctic or also the Antarctic?
So Antarctica, they're expecting like 1.5 degrees.
Okay.
So like nowhere near the extremes of the Arctic.
And is the reason that it's so much more extreme there kind of what you were hinting at earlier, just kind of like the composition of like the quote-unquote land that is there, or just like the structure of it versus like Antarctica maybe resembles more like a typical continent, you know, between the two?
Yeah, basically as ice melts in Antarctica, you're exposing like rock and continent, which don't heat up the same way the ocean does.
Okay.
And so when you get to the winter time, you know, the continent is cold, so ice can form on it. But when you get to the winter in the Arctic, the ocean is too warm, you can't get any ice on it. Because the ocean will cool at a much slower rate than land, which means that the Arctic isn't making as much ice in the fall as it should be. So by the time you get to the winter, you just have less ice in general, and it has to be warmer because of that.
What is the name of that property of water that means that it, like, cools more slowly?
The latent heat.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. Trying to remember my science from previous schooling. Okay, so I have a few more specific questions about this. And one is about, there were a few times that the term backcasting or... they actually used a different word, and I'm forgetting what it was.
Hindcasting.
Thank you. Were used. And I'm curious... how have you dealt with hindcasting? What is the importance of hindcasting in climate science?
So basically what hindcasting is sort of using climate models and data that we have observed to like predict what weather and climate was like in the past. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I personally haven't had to deal with that because my work has been sort of using pure observational data. I haven't tried to like, you know, make simulation, so I haven't had to deal with that, but it plays an important role in when people make these climate simulations, because the best way to test it is, you know, against the past. We know that it makes everything work. If everything works correctly, your simulation for the past like 100 years, and you know that all the physics and everything you know about the climate system works well for what you observed in the past, then you can reasonably assume it'll work decently well for the future. And they use hindcasting there just to like sort of like make more data to compare against. So it's sort of just like you run simulations backwards instead of like looking forward in time, looking backwards in time and see if it's predicting the right results.
So then you can use that going forward to say, okay, we have, using this hindcasting model, you know, we were able to show that in the past this matches up with what actually happened. So going forward, we can expect, you know, this model to accurately predict things.
Yeah, because okay. basically, like, they'll be like, well, let's see if we can see this model can predict, like, the 1980s. And it predicts everything that happened in the 1980s correctly. You can be like, okay, and it's reasonably fair to assume it's pretty good at predicting things in the future as well.
Hmm. So that's interesting to me. Is backcasting a way of being more certain about a model's ability to forecast?
Yeah.
And so there's not necessarily cases in which you would just be backcasting for the sake of backcasting?
Well, that also can be done, too, because one of the issues we have is that, so the Earth's climate operates on scales from, like, minutes and seconds to, like, thousands of years and even millions of years, and you get into sort of, like, how the Earth moves around the sun. And, you know, we want to make sure that observed trends are actually, like, significant changes and that they're, like, represent long-term changes in our climate. And to do that, you know, we've only been able, as a species, only been recording weather data for 150, 200 years max. We just didn't have thermometers or anything else until then, and no one was willing to waste time writing down how fast the wind was on January 12th, 1810, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in order to people do stuff, like, they, like, use, like, cores from, like, swamps in the ocean, and they look at the rock record to try to, like, recreate what the climate was like in the past, and, you know, they can constrain with accuracy what it was like. And then sort of you can also use this hindcasting to like check the check those results and sort of check your model against the more long-term climate history as well, but also just as a way of just like check. I mean, yeah, I guess I'm also not much of an expert in it, and I don't want to say too much about what it's used for, because I'm like hitting the edge of what I know, and I don't want to say anything wrong.
Okay, thank you for that self-awareness. Should we do a few more questions, go into some songs?
I think this might be a good place just to do a song, but then we can, you know, get back to those questions afterwards.
Okay. I did a quick keyword search for ice, and I found a Pink Floyd song, so let's see where this goes.
Perfect.
Sky may look blue.
Okay, welcome back. You just heard another song from Air. That was Le Voyage de Penelope. And previously to that was The Thing, The Thin Ice from Pink Floyd. So, we're going to
talk a little bit about probability.
Yeah.
Or just kind of certainty.
Yeah, so continuing from the article that Justin read and thinking about a bigger question of how scientists and especially climate scientists are working really hard to frame certainty and uncertainty, which is inherent in science, in a way that, you know, still communicates the urgency of it, is how I'm understanding this question.
Yeah. So when it comes to like climate science specifically, you know, you're dealing with, you know, incredibly chaotic data. Sample, let's look at just something I know about. Let's talk about snow for like Boston, right? Boston will have a year where it gets like, you know, 20 inches of snow, like way less than their average of like 42 inches. But then, you know, it'll have a year following where it gets like, you know, 100 inches of snow, like way above. And, you know, stuff like that just happens. There's so much variability between years, between events. And that's for one city. When you expand it to like the entirety of New England, and like how much snow each city gets changes wildly as you like move just a few miles away from Boston. And you find it to the globe, it gets even worse. You just have more and more variability at every single point. And on top of that, you know, what climate scientists are trying to do is prove that there are, you know, like these long-term changes in climate due to human activity and what, you know, kind of what is our impact on the climate system. But they have to deal with like this, you know, this, you know, this huge variability between years and months and days, but also this huge factor of the fact, like as I said earlier, the Earth operates on absolute from like, you know, timescales of minutes, timescales of like millions of years and hundreds of thousands of years. And, you know, how do you prove that what you're seeing is an actual significant change in climate when we have, you know, we as a species have only been recording data for 200 years and we can do reconstructions, we can do models, we can add more data. But, you know, unless you can go into the future, you can't like, you know, 100% guarantee that what you're seeing is a long-term change in climate. And, you know, because of that, it's hard for us as scientists to pick out, you know, pick out that, so say warming in the Arctic is just a, like, not a normal phenomenon that's supposed to happen every like couple thousand years we just don't know about, and pick out that it's something entirely driven by what we're doing. That's not just some relatively short term thing where, you know, because say, you know, the earth just the way it operates, it just has like, you know, there's a period just for 100 years the Arctic just has less ice, we just happen to live at the exact same time. You have to prove that that's not what's happening. And the climate system just is so chaotic and variable that it can be quite difficult. And even if you have like 100 studies agreeing this is like significant, you know, it's, and this change is happening, it still can be hard to be like, this is certainly 100%. And it's just a matter of the fact that, you know, we as species aren't that old. Are we collecting data is even younger. And the Earth is much older and operates on just wild timescales.
That kind of makes me think or wonder, and I don't know if this is me playing, I guess, devil's advocate, but as someone who believes in climate change and, you know, supports kind of research into that and also kind of fighting it, like you were saying, like, how do we not know that this is just something that the Earth, like, goes through? Like, how do we know that this, maybe this is just a, you know, maybe you just have to ride the wave or whatever, and that this is to be expected, but technically not for us to be expected because we weren't recording it, you know, because we weren't around.
Yeah. So, for certain things like temperature, we've constrained incredibly well through, like, reconstructions of climate for, like, you know, past 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, millions of years, you know, we're pretty sure. You can see when you look that, you know, the last like 100,000 years, 200,000 years is like a very strong period of like ice age. It melts, it's warm for a bit. Ice age, it melts, warm for a bit. Ice age, just melts, warm for a bit. And when you look at how long those, that sort of like the time between ice ages is, it's fairly constant for the time period we're in. But, and then you look at where we are relative to that, we should be getting colder. We should, you know, Earth should be like gearing up for an ice age. It should be getting colder on average every, like, over like 100 years or more. But it's not. It's doing the opposite. It's warming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nothing has really, and the things that would change its cycle would be the continents moving, but the continents haven't really moved that far in 100,000 years. And, you know, people have just repeatedly done studies proving that temperature change we're seeing is, you know, very, very anomalous, and it shouldn't be happening normally unless something new is added to the system. You know, and they do it with like stricter and stricter confidence, levels of confidence, like 99.99999% confidence or more sometimes. And they just keep beating into the ground that this is happening because of us. And, you know, for temperature, it's been pretty well done, because that's the thing that people have, like, cared the most about for the past, like, 50, 40, 60 years. But for other things, you know, no one was, you know, it's, we just don't really have good records of things like sea ice, like global sea ice, like how much sea ice there is on Earth until like the 70s and 80s when they first started having satellites can even look at it. Mm-hmm. And when you get to stuff like, you know, like winter weather, people have been just like historically people were bad at measuring it. They'd wait after a storm happened, and they'd be like, let the snow like compact on itself, because the snow is so heavy it'd push itself down and get smaller. So they're under measuring snow, or they're just like, they'll bring it in and melt it and just assume they're like, oh, you know, all snow gives you a constant amount of water depending on how tall it is, which isn't true. And they'll just say like, oh, 10 inches of snow equals 1 inch of water, so we can just multiply by that ratio to get how much snow there was on the ground. And other things are just out of convenience, because, you know, who wants to bother to go measure weather in 1822? And, you know, it's hard for a lot of things to just, you know, get that 99.99999% certainty that you know, it's human-driven climate change causing these things. And what scientists are trying to do is just show without a shadow of a doubt that this is what's happening. It's just like statistically they know that it's highly probable, or even like a very like significant like 99.9%. But, you know, as scientists, they want to show beyond an absolute shadow of a doubt that it is. And unfortunately, because when they talk in terms of statistics like that, like, oh, like 95%, 99%, people interpret it as, well, there's a pretty big chance that it isn't actually happening. Or they willfully interpret it that way because they have some other agenda. And that just is, unfortunately, an issue of climate science and statistical interpretation of it.
So you've been talking a bit about this side of the scientist's language of usually using confidence intervals and saying how confident they are, and then how that's interpreted by the public. And I actually have a listener wanted to submit a question for you, and it's in line with that. So this is a question from Declan. Oh. Just messaged it in and said, so I'm going to read the question.
Yeah.
Is it important for the general public to understand polar amplification? If so, why? Also, more generally, what can be done to improve science literacy about climate science?
So, I'll start with the first question, I guess. So, it's kind of hard. Polar amplification and the way it affects climate and sort of like where we live and where most people live, I personally couldn't explain it well enough that anybody anywhere could ever understand it. There probably people are, and I wish that they wrote more articles explaining it in a better way. And just even as like a phenomena, people haven't really talked about it. The first person they ever talked about was like 1980. But it wasn't until like the past like 5-10 years people actually start, like as a whole climate science started caring about it and seeing it could do those things. But I think the general public should care about it, because what it means is that sort of like it's probably a big driver behind all increases in extreme weather in general, like hurricanes and giant blizzards. And those are the weather events that we should care about, people should care about the most, because the ones that could actually kill them. And I think they should care about it. It's just an unfortunate matter of the fact that it's right now where it is kind of like locked behind a lot of scientific jargon. Like, the article I've written is one of the better ones on trying to explain it, and even then that was still like hard to grasp. And I, you know, and this goes to the general talk about scientific literacy in general, is that a lot of scientists write things for other scientists, and no one really writes things to the general public. And because of that, general public doesn't really have access to these sometimes incredibly important results to daily lives. And I think, you know, it needs to be, I think science in general should focus on trying to write things for people who aren't scientists. It's either the Journal of Weather or the Journal of Climate. I forget which one it is off the top of my head, but they've recently started doing, like, they'll have, like, the abstract of the article, and below it they'll have, like, a summary of the entire article and the key results just written at the level of the general public. And I think stuff like that needs to happen more, but although it has to be noted that it's, you know, a journal, and those are typically locked behind paywalls, and you have to be in an academic institution to access them in the first place. So while it is a good effort, it's not really solving the problem.
Cool. I am kind of interested to talk about space a little. I don't know if we are ready to transition there. Maybe we could do a quick song and then...
I think we are.
Is there anything else? Anyone have any lingering comments or things they want to talk about?
No.
I would like to say thank you again to Justin for reading this article, and Jenna for your good questions, and thank you to Declan for listening in and having that question. And if any, in the vein of public access to this sort of information, I would like to encourage any listeners, if you have questions, to call in at 855-915-9636, or if you want to...
They're also accessible via email.
Exactly.
At academicsonair@gmail.com, whatever mode of communication works best for you.
And maybe we can forward your question to Justin if you email it to us, the expert on this topic today.
Sure.
So also just one more thing I wanted to say on that, and what you were making me think of in your last comments, Justin, was that one major I was thinking about when I was coming into school, and particularly I saw... a field of study at Ithaca College for this was environmental journalism or other forms of science communication. And who knows, maybe at some point I will go into that field of work, but I do think it's really an important, increasingly important field of work, is that bridge between science and public.
Yeah, I agree, definitely. I don't know, just from like what I've seen working kind of in a journalism environment at NPR, I think it's very important. I think they do a great job of trying to bridge the gap between, you know, scientific literature and the public. I think there's also room for improvement in terms of making sure you kind of strike the right balance between conveying the results and, like, you know, making sensational headlines. And so sometimes, you know, science isn't always glamorous, and the results might not, you know, tell you anything definitive, but maybe they tell you, okay, it's not this, but we don't know what it is. So I think maybe we as a public need to be more okay with, like, science that doesn't give us, like, a direct answer for something, but maybe just points us more in the right direction.
Absolutely. Okay, on that note, we're going to head into a song and then a mini segment at the end of today's show about space. But for now, a classic Beatles tune.
Mother Nature's son. ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
8, 7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
You are listening to Academics on Air, and it is time for a public service announcement. Take it away.
Yeah, so this is an emergency preparedness PSA. Unexpected situations such as power outage, water disruption, or other emergency can happen at any time, so be prepared by having a couple of gallons of drinking water and a supply of food stored in your house. It's also an excellent idea to keep a few flashlights and other non-flammable light sources handy. Candles and other open flames can be very dangerous, and the worst possible time to cause a fire is when there's some other emergency going on. A public service message from Ready.gov and WMFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio.
Thank you, Justin.
Yes. And now, ground control to WMFO. You're listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Free Farm Radio. I'm a little early for the last 5 minutes, but it's 2:53. And now we're going to pivot a little bit and talk about some move kind of from climate change and Arctic and Antarctic. I forget the term already.
Amplification.
Thank you. To talk a little bit more broadly, a little bit more extraterrestrial about space. So Justin is the founder of SEDS, which again is Students
for the Exploration and Discovery of Space.
Development. I'm sorry. I shouldn't.
Wait, can you say the term so that we don't confuse the listeners?
Yeah, SEDS, Students for the Exploration and Development of Space.
Okay. Thank you. And just, I'm not positive if we said this at the beginning, but can you also say what your undergrad majors are?
Yeah, so I majored in astrophysics and environmental geology.
Okay. And you're going into a PhD program?
Yeah, I'm going to a PhD in atmospheric science.
Okay. So lots of exciting things there. And can you talk a little bit about SEDS and why you developed it and where you hope it will go?
Yeah, so SEDS as itself is like a international organization where like sort of like a bunch of college clubs all sort of like all kind of related under this one name, and they kind of all work together to sort of like spread to like, you know, increase interest in space in general and sort of help people get involved in the industry or just like express their love for it in some way. So this year, during the summer, the summit just happened, one of my friends, Sarah Carty, she had an internship called the Brooke Owens Fellowship, which helps women in STEM get amazing opportunities in the aerospace engineering field. And she, while she was there, one of her mentors, his name is Will Pomerantz, and he actually was on the board of directors for SEDS. And he kind of talked to her about it, and she really wanted to start one here at Tufts. So, you know, I asked her, you know, how her internship was going, and she responded like a couple days later, like 2 a.m, like, "Hey, want to start a club called SEDS?" And long story short, that's what we ended up doing. And it got much bigger over time. We initially expected around like 10 people to show up. We have about like 60 to 80 who routinely show up, which is blew our expectations out the water. And, you know, just made us so incredibly happy to see, like, there's just so many people at Tufts who, like, care about space and want to, like, be involved in it. And kind of where SEDS is at, where Tufts SEDS is at now, is that this past year we had kind of focused on, like, project teams and engineering stuff, and we had a rocketry team. They built 3 model rockets and launched them. One was entirely from scratch, and 2 were kits to get certifications. The other was like a high altitude weather balloon team, which is something I led, where essentially you basically take a box with a bunch of like instrumentation and some tracking stuff to like, you send it up into the atmosphere, like 40 to 80,000 feet, and you measure stuff about the atmosphere. You take cool pictures of the Earth, and then, you know, the balloon pops and it falls back down to Earth with the parachute safely, hopefully. Ours did, don't worry.
Does it fall somewhere you can access it, hopefully? So,
yeah, so you like run simulations to figure out where it's going to land. Ours, unfortunately, went like 100 miles off from where we thought it would land. So it landed in like northern New Hampshire on a place called Signal Mountain, which northern New Hampshire in this time of year is, it's kind of mountainous, kind of hard to get places. It's also covered in snow, and as all the snow is melting, there's like massive surges of meltwater and flooding across the part of the state there. So we were able to get within a mile of it. However, it was incredibly unsafe to like, you know, continue hiking and try and get it. So we ended up not retrieving it at the time. Our plan is to go back in a couple weeks when the snow has melted, and hopefully no one can get hurt trying to retrieve it. Our third team was trying to build something called a CubeSat, which is a very tiny, like 6 inch by 6 inch by 6 inch satellite. It's like a little cube, 6 inches in every direction, that you send into space, and it just does, you know, it just orbits around the Earth and does whatever you can fit inside of it, basically. And we're doing that in partnership with SEDS at MIT, SEDS Group's MIT and Northeastern University. But yeah, it ended up being just like such, you know, amazing year. We've gotten so much support from just from like Tufts in general, from departments around Tufts, particularly the physics department, the mechanical engineering department. Both of them have been like absolutely amazing, willing to like talk to us, help us out, give us space on campus to like work, give us, you know, money, which helped us bring all these projects to life. And eventually to like all the people who just like, you know, were willing to show up, you know, every Sunday, every week, and just like watch me, Sarah, and everyone else who's in charge of SES try and figure out how to lead a club way bigger than we thought and do all the things we wanted to do. And, you know, we had our last meeting actually last week, and it was just, I don't know, it was so kind of just, it meant a lot to just like have that meeting and just be like, everyone just showed up and was like happy to like be there and like really loved the club. And going forward next year, we actually want, you know, because SED's got a big one, to actually, we're adding more projects, which are actually really cool. One of them is kind of a collaboration with Tufts Robotics and Tufts Make, where we're actually building and designing a Mars rover for a NASA competition. And the other project is something we're doing with the physics department, where we want to try and build and operate a student-owned and developed radio telescope. Wow. And put it on top of 574.
What would that do? What is a radio telescope?
So basically, a regular telescope, right, you point it in light, and like, you know, visible light comes in, and you can look at it and see images. Well, what a radio telescope does is it takes radio waves and sort of gives you like how strong radio signal is at like certain frequencies when you're pointing it somewhere in the sky. And we as like, you know, as scientists in general, have been able to figure out, like, you know, you expect